Listen carefully, Albert, Nick said. We have to take her on board the plane, but we'll need a litter to do it. There won't be one on board, but there must be one in here. Where?
Gee, Mr. Hopewell, Captain Engel would know better than...
But Captain Engel isn't here, Nick said patiently. We shall have to manage on our own. Albert frowned, then thought of a sign he had seen on the lower level. Airport services, he asked. Does that sound right?
It bloody well does, Nick said. Where did you see that?
On the lower level, next to the rent-a-car counters.
All right, Nick said. Here's how we're going to handle this. You and Mr. Gaffney are designated litter finders and litter bearers. Mr. Gaffney, I suggest you check by the grill behind the counter. I expect you'll find some sharp knives. I'm sure that's where our unpleasant friend found his. Get one for you and one for Albert. Don went behind the counter without a word. Rudy Warwick returned from the Red Baron bar with an armload of red and white checked tablecloths.
I'm really sorry,
he began again, but Nick cut him off. He was still looking at Albert, his face now only a circle of white above the deeper shadow of Dinah's small body. The dark had almost arrived.
You probably won't see Mr. Toomey. My guess is that he left here unarmed, in a panic. I imagine he's either found a bolt hole by now, or he has left the terminal. If you do see him, I advise you very strongly not to engage him unless he makes it necessary. He swung his head to look at Don as Don returned with a pair of butcher knives.
Keep your priorities straight, you two. Your mission isn't to recapture Mr. Toomey and bring him to justice. Your job is to get a stretcher and bring it here as quick as you can. We have to get out of here.
Don offered Albert one of the knives, but Albert shook his head and looked at Rudy Warwick. Could I have one of those tablecloths instead? Don looked at him as if Albert had gone crazy.
A tablecloth? What in God's name for?
I'll show you. Albert had been kneeling by Dinah. Now he got up and went behind the counter. He peered around, not sure exactly what he was looking for, but positive he would know it when he saw it. And so he did. There was an old-fashioned two-slice toaster sitting well back on the counter. He picked it up, jerking the plug out of the wall, and wrapped the cord tightly around it as he came back to where the others were. He took one of the tablecloths, spread it, and placed the toaster in one corner. Then he turned it over twice, wrapping the toaster in the end of the tablecloth like a Christmas present. He fashioned tight rabbit's ear knots in the corners to make a pocket. When he gripped the loose end of the tablecloth and stood up, the wrapped toaster had become a rock and a makeshift sling.
When I was a kid, we used to play Indiana Jones, Albert said apologetically. I made something like this and pretended it was my whip. I almost broke my brother David's arm once. I loaded an old blanket with a sash weight I found in the garage. Pretty stupid, I guess. I didn't know how hard it would hit. I got a hell of a spanking for it. It looks stupid, I guess, but it actually works pretty well. It always did, at least.
Nick looked at Albert's makeshift weapon dubiously, but said nothing. If a toaster wrapped in a tablecloth made Albert feel more comfortable about going downstairs in the dark, so be it.
Good enough, then. Now go find a stretcher and bring it back. If there isn't one in the airport services office, try someplace else. If you don't find anything in 15 minutes, make that 10. Just come back and we'll carry her.
You can't do that, Laura cried softly. If there's internal bleeding...
Nick looked up at her.
There's internal bleeding already, and 10 minutes is all the time I think we can spare.
Laurel opened her mouth to answer, to argue, but Dinah's husky whisper stopped her.
He's right.
Don slipped the blade of his knife into his belt.
Come on, son, he said.
They crossed the terminal together and started down the escalator to the first floor. Albert wrapped the end of his loaded tablecloth around his hand as they went. Nick turned his attention back to the girl on the floor. How are you feeling, Dinah?
Hurts bad,
Dinah said faintly. Yes, of course it does, Nick said. Now I'm afraid that what I'm about to do is going to make it hurt a good deal more, for a few seconds at least. But the knife is in your lung, and it's got to come out. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
Her dark, unseen eyes looked up at him.
Scared.
So am I, Dinah. So am I, but it has to be done. Are you game?
Yes.
Good girl.
Nick bent and planted a soft kiss on her cheek. That's a good, brave girl. It won't take long, and that's a promise. I want you to lie just as still as you can, Dinah, and try not to cough. Do you understand me? It's very important. Try not to cough.
I'll try.
There may be a moment or two when you feel that you can't breathe. You may even feel that you're leaking, like a tire with a puncture. That's a scary feeling, love. And it may make you want to move around or cry out. You mustn't do it, and you mustn't cough. Dinah made a reply none of them could hear. Nick swallowed, armed sweat off his forehead in a quick gesture, and turned to Laurel. Fold two of those tablecloths into square pads, thick as you can. Kneel beside me, close as you can get. Warwick, take off your belt. Rudy began to comply at once. Nick looked back at Laurel. She was again struck, and not unpleasantly this time, by the power of his gaze. I'm going to grasp the handle of the knife and draw it out. If it's not caught on one of her ribs, and judging from its position, I don't think it is, the blade should come out in one slow, smooth pull. The moment it's out, I will draw back, giving you clear access to the girl's chest area. You will place one of your pads over the wound and press. Press hard. You're not to worry about hurting her or compressing her chest so much she can't breathe. She's got at least one perforation in her lung, and I'm betting there's a pair of them. Those are what we've got to worry about. Do you understand?
Yes.
When you've placed the pad, I'm going to lift her against the pressure you're putting on. Mr. Warwick here will then slip the other pad beneath her if we see blood on the back of her dress. Then we're going to tie the compresses in place with Mr. Warwick's belt. He glanced up at Rudy. When I call for it, my friend, give it to me. Don't make me ask you twice.
I won't.
Can you see well enough to do this, Nick? Laurel asked.
I think so, Nick replied. I hope so. He looked at Dinah again. Ready?
Dinah muttered something.
All right, Nick said. He drew in a long breath and then let it out. Jesus, help me.
He wrapped his slim, long-fingered hands around the handle of the knife like a man gripping a baseball bat. He pulled. Dinah shrieked. A great gout of blood spewed from her mouth. Laurel had been leaning tensely forward, and her face was suddenly bathed in Dinah's blood. She recoiled.
No! Nick spat at her without looking around. Don't you dare go weak sister on me! Don't you dare!
Laurel leaned forward again, gagging and shuddering. The blade, a dully gleaming triangle of silver in the deep gloom, emerged from Dinah's chest and glimmered in the air. The little blind girl's chest heaved, and there was a high, unearthly whistling sound as the wound sucked inward.
Now, Nick grunted, press down, hard as you can.
Laurel leaned forward. For just a moment she saw blood pouring out of the hole in Dinah's chest, and then the wound was covered. The tablecloth pad grew warm and wet under her hands almost immediately.
Harder, Nick snarled at her. Press harder, seal it, seal the wound.
Laurel now understood what people meant when they talked about coming completely unstrung, because she felt on the verge of it herself.
I can't. I'll break her ribs if... Fuck her ribs! You have to make a seal!
Laurel rocked forward on her knees and brought her entire weight down on her hands. Now she could feel liquid seeping slowly between her fingers, although she had folded the tablecloth thick. The Englishman tossed the knife aside and leaned forward until his face was almost touching Dinah's. Her eyes were closed. He rolled one of the lids. I think she's finally out, he said. Can't tell for sure because her eyes are so odd. But I hope to heaven she is. Hair had fallen over his brow. He tossed it back impatiently with a jerk of his head and looked at Laurel. You're doing well. Stay with it, all right? I'm rolling her now. Keep the pressure on as I do.
There's so much blood, Laura groaned. Will she drown?
I don't know. Keep the pressure on. Ready, Mr. Warwick?
Oh, Christ, I guess so, Rudy Warwick croaked.
Right, here we go.
Nick slipped his hands beneath Dinah's right shoulder blade and grimaced. It's worse than I thought, he muttered. Far worse. She's soaked. He began to pull Dinah slowly upward against the pressure Laurel was putting on. Dinah uttered a thick, croaking moan. A gout of half-congealed blood flew from her mouth and spattered across the floor. And now Laurel could hear a rain of blood pattering down on the carpet from beneath the girl. Suddenly, the world began to swim away from her.
Keep that pressure on, Nick cried. Don't let up!
But she was fainting. It was her understanding of what Nick Hopewell would think of her if she did faint which caused her to do what she did next. Laurel stuck her tongue out between her teeth like a child making a face and bit down on it as hard as she could. The pain was bright and exquisite. The salty taste of her own blood immediately filled her mouth. But that sensation that the world was swimming away from her like a big lazy fish in an aquarium passed. She was here again. Downstairs there was a sudden shriek of pain and surprise. It was followed by a hoarse shout. On the heels of the shout came a loud, drilling scream. Rudy and Laurel both turned in that direction.
"The boy," Rudy said. "Him and Gaffney, they..."
"They found Mr. Toomey after all," Nick said. His face was a complicated mask of effort. The tendons on his neck stood out like steel pulleys.
"We'll just have to help."
There was a thud from downstairs, followed by a terrible howl of agony, then a whole series of muffled thumps.
"That they're on top of the situation. We can't do anything about it now. If we stop in the middle of what we're doing, this little girl is going to die for sure." "But that sounded like the kid." "Can't be helped, can it? Slide the pad under her, Warwick. Do it right now, or I'll kick your bloody ass square."
Don led the way down the escalator, then stopped briefly at the bottom to fumble in his pocket. He brought out a square object that gleamed faintly in the dark.
"It's my Zippo," he said. "Do you think it'll still work?"
"I don't know," Albert said. "It might, for a while. You better not try it until you have to. I sure hope it does. We won't be able to see a thing without it."
"Where's this airport services place?"
Albert pointed to the door Craig Toomey had gone through less than 5 minutes before. "Right over there."
"Do you think it's unlocked?"
"Well," Albert said, "there's only one way to find out." They crossed the terminal, Don still leading the way with his lighter in his right hand. Craig heard them coming. More servants of the Langoliers, no doubt. But he wasn't worried. He had taken care of the thing which had been masquerading as a little girl, and he would take care of these other things as well. He curled his hand around the letter opener, got up, and sidled back around the desk.
"Do you think it's unlocked?"
"Well, there's only one way to find out."
"You're going to find out something anyway," Craig thought.
He reached the wall beside the door. It was lined with paper-stacked shelves. He reached out and felt door hinges. Good. The opening door would block him off from them. Not that they were likely to see him, anyway. It was as black as an elephant's asshole in here. He raised the letter opener to shoulder height.
"The knob doesn't move."
Craig relaxed, but only for a moment. "Try pushing it." That was the smart-ass kid. The door began to open. Don stepped in, blinking at the gloom. He thumbed the cover of his lighter back, held it up, and flicked the wheel. There was a spark, and the wick caught at once, producing a low flame. They saw what was apparently a combined office and storeroom. There was an untidy stack of luggage in one corner and a Xerox machine in another. The back wall was lined with shelves, and the shelves were stacked with what looked like forms of various kinds. Don stepped further into the office, lifting his lighter like a spelunker holding up a guttering candle in a dark cave. He pointed to the right wall.
"Hey, kid. Ace, look."
A poster mounted there showed a tipsy guy in a business suit staggering out of a bar and looking at his watch. "Work is the curse of the drinking class," the poster advised. Mounted on the wall beside it was a white plastic box with a large red cross on it, and leaning below it was a folded stretcher, the kind with wheels. Albert wasn't looking at the poster or the first aid kit or the stretcher, however. His eyes were fixed on the desk in the center of the room. On it, he saw a heaped tangle of paper strips.
"Look out," he shouted. "Look out, he's in here."
Craig Toomey stepped up from behind the door and struck. "Belt," Nick said. Rudy didn't move or reply. His head was turned toward the door of the restaurant. The sounds from downstairs had ceased. There was only the rattling noise and the steady, throbbing rumble of the jet engine in the dark outside. Nick kicked backward like a mule connecting with Rudy's shin.
"Ow! Belt! Now!"
Rudy dropped clumsily to his knees and moved next to Nick, who was holding Dinah up with one hand and pressing a second tablecloth pad against her back with the other.
"Slip it under the pad," Nick said.
He was panting, and sweat was running down his face in wide streams. "Quick! I can't hold her up forever." Rudy slid the belt under the pad. Nick lowered Dinah, reached across the girl's small body, and lifted her left shoulder long enough to pull the belt out the other side. Then he looped it over her chest and cinched it tight. He put the belt's free end in Laurel's hand. "Keep the pressure on," he said, standing up. "You can't use the buckle. She's much too small."
"Are you going downstairs?" Laurel asked.
"Yes, that seems indicated."
"Be careful. Please be careful."
He grinned at her, and all those white teeth suddenly shining out in the gloom were startling, but not frightening, she discovered. Quite the opposite. "Of course. It's how I get along." He reached down and squeezed her shoulder. His hand was warm, and at his touch a little shiver chased through her. "You did very well, Laurel. Thank you." He began to turn away, and then a small hand groped out and caught the cuff of his blue jeans. He looked down and saw that Dinah's blind eyes were open again.
"Don't,"
she began, and then a choked sneezing fit shook her. Blood flew from her nose in a spray of fine droplets. "Dinah, you mustn't."
"Don't. You kill him," she said.
And even in the dark, Laurel could sense the fantastic effort she was making to speak at all. Nick looked down at her thoughtfully. "The bugger stabbed you, you know. Why are you so insistent on keeping him whole?" Her narrow chest strained against the belt. The blood-stained tablecloth pad heaved. She struggled and managed to say one thing more. They all heard it. Dinah was at great pains to speak clearly.
"All I know is that we need him,"
she whispered, and then her eyes closed again. Craig buried the letter opener fist deep in the nape of Don Gaffney's neck. Don screamed and dropped the lighter. It struck the floor and lay there, guttering sickishly. Albert shouted in surprise as he saw Craig step toward Don, who was now staggering in the direction of the desk and clawing weakly behind him for the protruding object. Craig grabbed the opener with one hand and planted his other against Don's back. As he simultaneously pushed and pulled, Albert heard the sound of a hungry man pulling a drumstick off a well-done turkey. Don screamed again, louder this time, and went sprawling over the desk. His arms flew out ahead of him, knocking to the floor an in-out box and a stack of lost luggage forms Craig had been ripping. Craig turned toward Albert, flicking a spray of blood droplets from the blade of the letter opener as he did so.
"You're one of them, too," he breathed. "Well, fuck you. I'm going to Boston, and you can't stop me. None of you can stop me."
Then the lighter on the floor went out, and they were in darkness. Albert took a step backward and felt a warm swoop of air in his face as Craig swung the blade through the spot where he had been only a second before. He flailed behind him with his free hand, terrified of backing into a corner where Craig could use the knife on him at will. In the Zippo's pallid fading light, that was what he thought it was. And his own weapon would be useless as well as stupid. His fingers found only empty space, and he backed through the door into the lobby. He did not feel cool. He did not feel like the fastest Hebrew on any side of the Mississippi. He did not feel faster than Blue Blazes. He felt like a scared kid who had foolishly chosen a childhood play toy instead of a real weapon because he had been unable to believe, really, really believe, that it could come to this in spite of what that lunatic asshole had done to the little girl upstairs. He could smell himself. Even in the dead air, he could smell himself. It was the rancid monkey piss aroma of fear. Craig came gliding out through the door with the letter opener raised. He moved like a dancing shadow in the dark.
"I see you, Sonny," he breathed. "I see you just like a cat."
He began to slide forward. Albert backed away from him. At the same time, he began to pendulum the toaster back and forth, reminding himself that he would have only one good shot before Toomey moved in and planted the blade in his throat or chest. "And if the toaster goes flying out of the goddamn pocket before it hits him, I'm a goner." Craig closed in, weaving the top half of his body from side to side like a snake coming out of a basket. An absent little smile touched the corners of his lips and made small dimples there.
"That's right,"
Craig's father said grimly from his undying stronghold inside Craig's head.
"If you have to pick them off one by one, you can do that. EPO, Craig, remember? EPO. Effort pays off."
"That's right, Craigy Waggy," his mother chimed in. "You can do it, and you have to do it."
"I'm sorry," Craig murmured to the white-faced boy through his smile.
"I'm really, really sorry, but I have to do it. If you could see things from my perspective, you'd understand."
Albert shot a quick glance behind him and saw that he was backing toward the United Airlines ticket desk. If he retreated much further, the backward arc of his swing would be restricted. It had to be soon. He began to pendulum the toaster more rapidly, his sweaty hand clutching the twist of tablecloth. Craig caught the movement in the dark, but couldn't tell what it was the kid was swinging. It didn't matter. He couldn't let it matter. He gathered himself, then sprang forward.
I'm going to Boston, he shrieked. I'm going to...
Albert's eyes were adjusting to the dark, and he saw Craig make his move. The toaster was on the rearward half of its arc. Instead of snapping his wrist forward to reverse its direction, Albert let his arm go with the weight of the toaster, swinging it up and over his head in an exaggerated pitching gesture. At the same time, he stepped to the left. The lump at the end of the tablecloth made a short, hard circlet in the air, held firmly in its pocket by centripetal force. Craig cooperated by stepping forward into the toaster's descending arc. It met his forehead and the bridge of his nose with a hard, toneless crunch. Craig wailed with agony and dropped the ladder opener. His hands went to his face and he staggered backward. Blood from his broken nose poured between his fingers like water from a busted hydrant. Albert was terrified of what he had done, but was even more terrified of letting up now that Toomey was hurt. Albert took another step to the left and swung the tablecloth sidearm. It whipped through the air and smashed into the center of Craig's chest with a hard thump. Craig fell over backward, still howling. For Albert Ace Costner, only one thought remained. All else was a tumbling, fragmented swirl of color, image, and emotion. I have to make him stop moving, or he'll get up and kill me. I have to make him stop moving, or he'll get up and kill me. At least Toomey had dropped his weapon. It lay glinting on the lobby carpet. Albert planted one of his loafers on it and unloaded with the toaster again. As it came down, Albert bowed from the waist like an old-fashioned butler greeting a member of the royal family. The lump at the end of the tablecloth smashed into Craig Toomey's gasping mouth. There was a sound like glass being crushed inside of a handkerchief.
Oh, God, Albert thought. That was his teeth.
Craig flopped and squirmed on the floor. It was terrible to watch him, perhaps more terrible because of the poor light. There was something monstrous and unkillable and insectile about his horrible vitality. His hand closed upon Albert's loafer. Albert stepped away from the letter opener with a little cry of revulsion, and Craig tried to grasp it when he did. Between his eyes, his nose was a burst bulb of flesh. He could hardly see Albert at all. His vision was eaten up by a vast white corona of light. A steady, high-keening note rang in his head. The sound of a TV test pattern turned up to full volume. He was beyond doing any damage, but Albert didn't know it. In a panic, he brought the toaster down on Craig's head again. There was a metallic crunch rattle as the heating elements inside it broke free. Craig stopped moving. Albert stood over him, sobbing for breath, the weighted tablecloth dangling from one hand. Then he took two long, shambling steps toward the escalator, bowed deeply again, and vomited on the floor. Brian crossed himself as he thumbed back the black plastic shield which covered the screen of the 767's INS video display terminal, half expecting it to be smooth and blank. He looked at it closely and let out a deep sigh of relief. Last program complete, it informed him in cool blue-green letters. And below that, new program, YN. Brian tapped Y. Then, reverse AP-29, LAX, Logan. The screen went dark for a moment. Then, include diversion in reverse program AP-29, YN. Brian typed Y. Computing reverse, the screen informed him, and less than 5 seconds later, program complete. Captain Angle? He turned around. Bethany was standing in the cockpit doorway. She looked pale and haggard in the cabin lights.
I'm a little busy right now, Bethany.
Why aren't they back?
I can't say.
I asked Bob, Mr. Jenkins, if he could see anyone moving inside the terminal, and he said he couldn't.
What if they're all dead?
I'm sure they're not. If it will make you feel any better, why don't you join them at the bottom of the ladder? I've got some more work to do here. At least I hope I do.
Are you scared? She asked.
Yes, I sure am. She smiled a little.
I'm sort of glad. It's bad to be scared all by yourself. Totally bogus. I'll leave you alone now.
Thanks. I'm sure they'll be out soon. She left. Brian turned back to the INS monitor and typed, Are there problems with this program? He hit execute. No problems. Thank you for flying American Pride.
You're welcome, I'm sure, Brian murmured, and he wiped his forehead with his sleeve.
Now, he thought, if only the fuel will burn. Bob heard footsteps on the ladder and turned quickly. It was only Bethany descending slowly and carefully, but he still felt jumpy. The sound coming out of the east was gradually growing louder, closer. Hi, Bethany. May I borrow another of your cigarettes? She offered the depleted pack to him, then took one herself. She had tucked Albert's book of experimental matches into the cellophane covering the pack, and when she tried one, it lit easily.
Any sign of them?
Well, it all depends on what you mean by any sign, I guess, Bob said cautiously. I think I heard some shouting just before you came down. What he had heard actually sounded like screaming, shrieking, not to put too fine a point on it. But he saw no reason to tell the girl that. She looked as frightened as Bob felt, and he had an idea she'd taken a liking to Albert.
I hope Dinah's going to be all right, she said. But I don't know. He got her really bad.
Did you see the captain? Bethany nodded.
He sort of kicked me out. I guess he's programming his instruments or something.
Bob Jenkins nodded soberly.
I hope so.
Conversation lapsed. They both looked east. A new and even more ominous sound now underlay the crunching, chewing noise. A high, inanimate screaming. It was a strangely mechanical sound, one that made Bob think of an automatic transmission low on fluid.
It's a lot closer now, isn't it?
Bob nodded reluctantly. He drew on his cigarette, and the glowing ember momentarily illuminated a pair of tired, terrified eyes.
What do you suppose it is, Mr. Jenkins?
He shook his head slowly. Dear girl, I hope we never have to find out. Halfway down the escalator, Nick saw a bent-over figure standing in front of the useless bank of pay telephones. It was impossible to tell if it was Albert or Craig Toomey. The Englishman reached into his right front pocket, holding his left hand against it to prevent any jingling, and by touch selected a pair of quarters from his change. He closed his right hand into a fist and slipped the quarters between his fingers, creating a makeshift set of brass knuckles. Then he continued down to the lobby. The figure by the telephones looked up as Nick approached. It was Albert.
Don't step in the puke, he said dully.
Nick dropped the quarters back into his pocket and hurried to where the boy was standing with his hands propped above his knees, like an old man who has badly overestimated his capacity for exercise. He could smell the high, sour stench of vomit. That and the sweaty stink of fear coming off the boy were smells with which he was all too familiar. He knew them from the Falklands, and even more intimately from Northern Ireland. He put his left arm around the boy's shoulders, and Albert straightened very slowly.
Where are they, Ace? Nick asked quietly.
Gaffney and Toomey, where are they?
Mr. Toomey's there.
He pointed toward a crumpled shape on the floor.
Mr. Gaffney's in the airport services office. I think they're both dead. Mr. Toomey was in the airport services office. Behind the door, I guess. He killed Mr. Gaffney because Mr. Gaffney walked in first. If I'd walked in first, he would have killed me instead.